Why don't you turn to Judges chapter 8 with me? We are now in part 3 of our Gideon story. The Gideon story was a fairly lengthy one, so we had to break it down into 3 parts, and even that was almost difficult to get it into 3 parts. So we're finishing up our story of Gideon this morning. Let's do a quick review of what we've learned so far. Last week we saw God deliver Israel through the hand of Gideon and this little tiny army of 300 people. And you have to remember that he was going up against an army of 135,000 soldiers. And so it was a divine miracle, if you will. We saw this contrast in the story between the weakness of Gideon and his army and Israel's weakness up against this formidable enemy, and had that contrasted with God's strength as well. In fact, the story started off with God telling Gideon that he was not able to deliver the Israel army with the original 35,000 soldiers they had, and decided to whittle that down through some interesting events, including taking the soldiers to the water and watching how they would lap up the water. And God said he did that to prevent Israel from becoming proud and boastful and saying that they had delivered themselves by their own hand. And as we looked at that story, we saw how this reflects our own salvation. While we are helpless to rescue ourselves from sin and from death, God raised up a deliverer, Jesus Christ, to do it for us. And he made it so that we would have no opportunity to boast. In fact, the scripture tells us that our salvation is purely a gift of grace through faith, so that we ourselves cannot boast about our salvation. And that's the picture we saw in this Gideon story. We saw some different sides of Gideon as well. We saw a little bit of maturity and growth. We started off with this timid farm boy, if you remember. When we first met Gideon, he was threshing wheat in a wine press, which is a strange place to thresh wheat because you wouldn't normally do it in a wine press. But because the Midianites were coming down during the harvest season and ransacking the crops and bringing all their cattle and their animals to graze on the Israelites' land, they had to go up and hide in caves and other places to try to keep their food. And so Gideon was in the wine press hiding his wheat there, assuming that the Midianites wouldn't find it. And then we see the Lord come to him and refer to him as a valiant warrior, which is a foreshadowing of what he would become. But we have this interesting interplay between Gideon and the angel, and a little bit later with the Lord himself. And we saw him be a little bit timid. You remember the story where he goes and he tears down his father's altar to Baal. He does it at nighttime. And then we saw as he uses the fleece to try to make sure that God is really speaking to him. And he puts the fleece out and he's very cautious about the way that he asks God, "Will you, you know, make it wet and make the ground dry?" And God does it. And he says, "Well, please be patient with me. Let's reverse that and do it again." And so we have this rather shy individual. But then as he begins to follow God's direction, we see a scene where he goes down into the Midianite camp to listen. God sends him down there the night before the attack so that he might listen to what the soldiers are talking about. Remember, they had a vision where these two Midianite soldiers talked about how God was going to defeat them with this little band of men from Gideon's army. And as Gideon hears that, he begins to develop some courage and goes back to his men and he rises them up and they prepare him for the attack. And so we see this amazing event take place. Gideon's army goes in and ransacks the Midianites, kills almost all of 130, or God actually kills 135,000 people, 15,000 left over, so about 120,000 soldiers that God wipes out. And so that's where we kind of pick up today, because this section here is actually a continuation of chapter 7. It's the mop-up, if you will. When God sent all these soldiers against themselves as Gideon's 300 men surrounded their camp and blew their trumpets and waved their torches, God wiped out 120,000 of these men and 15,000 escaped. And so now Gideon is on the pursuit and chasing these men down. And so we'll pick up that story today. But what's interesting about this section today is it's both disturbing and difficult for us to understand. The reason it's difficult is because there are some interpretive challenges in the book, in this chapter specifically. But it's also disturbing because if we are interpreting the passages, or this passage this morning, properly, it's going to show a troubling side of Gideon. We're going to see this man who should be hailed as a hero, but we're going to see sort of a dark side, and it's something that's sort of difficult for us to accept and a little bit disturbing. So it's going to be a challenge for us today. We're going to go ahead and look at it. Look at the first three verses. This is, again, at this tail end of this battle where Gideon is now pursuing the remaining 15,000 Midianites that are trying to escape the battle and go back to their homeland. And so Gideon sets out to pursue them. And during that process, Ephraim, one of the tribes of Israel, is going to come against Gideon. They're going to come and complain against him. So that's verses 1 through 3. So chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, I'll read those. Then the men of Ephraim said to him, "What is this thing you have done to us, not calling us when you went to fight against Midian?" And they contended with him vigorously. But he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes in Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has given the leaders of Midian, Oreb, and Zeb into your hands. And what I was able to do in comparison with you..." Then their anger toward him subsided when he said that. So what we basically have here is Gideon, under God's command and control, goes and basically destroys the Midianites. And Ephraim is upset because Gideon did not ask Ephraim to help prior to that battle. He called upon him afterwards to help with the mop-up, but these Gideonites come to him and they're offended by his actions. They wanted to be part of the action, and apparently they felt Gideon didn't give them that opportunity. And so they're complaining against him. Now, this is the first time they do this. There's another instance later on where they do it again against the judge. There may have been some pride there on their behalf. We don't see any indication that they offered to help beforehand, but certainly were interested now after the fact. So as the Midianites began to flee, Gideon calls upon the tribes of Ephraim and three others, and it's at that point that they apparently learn of the plan and they get a little bit upset. And so they accuse him of doing some kind of wrong here. Now we see in Gideon an interesting political move here, if you will, because he uses a little bit of political savvy, if you will, to navigate this difficult time. And you see in the text there, he basically says, verse 2, "What have I done in comparison with you?" In other words, he's saying, "Well, I'm just this little guy. You guys have done much greater things than me. You're surely more important than me." He says, is not the gleaning of the grapes in Ephraim much better than the vintage in Abiezer? In other words, isn't your wine much greater than anything I would ever possess? He's basically flattering these folks, trying to win them over. And their response is, "Well, okay, we feel better now." And so their anger subsides. Now, the text indicates here that this was a pretty stern confrontation. They were not happy. When they do this again in a later chapter, they actually threaten to burn down the judge's house. And it actually leads to a civil war. And so these are folks that are upset. They're angry. And we see a side of Gideon here that's kind of cool in that he was able to appease through political means, avoid any real conflict with his brothers, because these are Israelites. So he does his best to appease them. But I think we look at this, and I think we begin to see the beginnings of some internal strife take place here. And we will see that throughout the book. This will lead to civil war, ultimately. And we see that Israel is somewhat divided. They're each doing their own thing. There's no necessary unity, or there's not necessarily any unity among them. And so this is sort of the beginnings. It's like a foreshadowing of some things that are going to come because of their sin. Remember, they're falling prey to Baal worship and other things. And that affects everything, including personal relationships among the tribes. And it's the same thing with us, isn't it? When our relationship with Christ is not what it should be, it makes our lives with one another much more difficult, doesn't it? And that's what I think we're beginning to see here with Israel. I think it serves also, this little episode here, as just a hint of what's going to happen later on with Ephraim in the beginning of a civil war. So what happens next? Well, verses 4 through 9, Gideon's going to make his way now to two cities, Succoth and Penuel, and he's going to ask for their help, but it doesn't go exactly as he had hoped or planned. Look at starting in verse 4. "Then Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the Jordan and crossed over, weary yet pursuing. He said to the men of Succoth, 'Please give loaves of bread to the people who are following me, for they are weary, and I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian.' The leaders of Succoth said, 'Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands, that we should give bread to your army?' Gideon said, 'All right, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will thrash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars.' who went up from there to Penuel and spoke similarly to them. And the men of Penuel answered him just as the men of Succoth had answered. So he spoke also to the men of Penuel, saying, "When I return safely, I will tear down this tower." So what's actually happening here? Succoth was actually located east of the Jordan River. That's what we refer to as the Transjordan. You remember when Joshua took the tribes into Israel, two tribes decided they wanted to stay on the other side of the river. It's called the Transjordan. It's on the east side of the Jordan River. The Promised Land was supposed to be on the west-hand side, but they wanted to stay on the east side. And so Moses cut a deal with them. He said, "All right, we'll let you have that land, but you have to come across the Jordan, help us fight within the Promised Land, conquer the city-states, and once all that's done, after you help your brothers in Israel conquer the land, you can go back over. However, there's a condition. If you go back over, you must always be available to help when Israel calls upon you." And so that's where this city, Succoth, is actually located. It's across the Jordan River. And so as Gideon is pursuing the Midianites and they're fleeing back in that direction, his army comes across. They're weary. They're without food. They need some help. And so they stop at this city and they ask these men for help. Now, the text doesn't really specifically tell us whether or not Succoth is an Israelite city or if it's Canaanite city. However, I think there's enough evidence to indicate that it was an Israelite city, meaning these were part of the Israelite tribe living on that side of the Jordan. And the reason for it, I'll give you a couple of reasons why. Joshua specifically mentions this city by name when he's describing the borders of Gad. This was one of the border cities of the tribe of Gad that inherited that Transjordan area. And those cities were extremely important because they protected Israel. And so usually those border cities were military places. And so there's good reason that with Joshua mentioning that Gad was an important city for, I'm sorry, that Succoth was an important city for Gad. It was probably an Israelite city conquered and controlled by Israel. Later, Succoth becomes a place where they make the brass that's used in the temple. And you wouldn't expect that if it was a Canaanite city. The inhabitants of the city, actually, pretty much here in this verse, clearly are afraid of the Midianites. Because what's their answer that they give to Gideon? When Gideon asks them just to feed his army, doesn't even ask them to take up arms, but just feed my army. They're afraid to do it because Gideon hadn't completely conquered the Midianites yet. And so the response is, well, wait a minute. So if we help you and you don't conquer them, the Midianites are going to come back and conquer us. So they're hedging their bets. And why would they do that? If they were Canaanites, they wouldn't be enemies with the Midianites. They'd be enemies with the Israelites. So the fact that they're afraid of the Midianites, really more than they are Gideon, means they're probably Israelites. Because again, they'd be afraid of the Midianites. I mean, they wouldn't be afraid of the Midianites if they were just Canaanites themselves. So, there's also an indication that Gideon approaches Succoth with the expectation that they should help. Remember, they were supposed to help. The Israelites on the other side of the Jordan, that was the deal that Moses cut. And we don't get anything in this passage here that Gideon expects anything less than their help. He simply asks them, feed us. And when they don't feed him, he gets very angry and very upset with them. And so again, that would indicate that they're just not carrying out what Moses commanded them to carry out. And there's other things in the text as well that would indicate that these were Israelites, and they should have helped Gideon when he asked. So when he asked them to help, they basically say, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands?" In other words, have you already conquered them? Should we give bread to your army when you haven't done that already? So they refuse out of fear of retribution from the Midianites, and they hedge their bets. In verse 15, a little bit later in this chapter, we find that the refusal to help actually wasn't just a simple no, but they actually taunted Gideon. In other words, they really didn't expect that Gideon would be able to conquer these Midianites. Remember, 300 men going up against 15,000. Anybody with a rational mind would say, "Are you kidding me? We'd be nuts to support these people. They're going to get wiped out. And then the Midianites are going to come back to us." And so they weren't just simply saying, "Well, Gideon, we're afraid. We're really afraid." According to verse 15, they taunted him. It was more like saying, "Yeah, right. You really think your men of 300 is going to be able to wipe these guys out? We'd be nuts to feed you. Scoot along. Don't bother us. So Gideon responds to that with a threat. And this is where it becomes, I think, difficult for us. He actually responds with a threat. And this is a pretty graphic threat. Look at what he says in verse 7. All right. Have it your way. When the Lord has given Zalmunna into my hand, then I will thrash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. Basically, he makes a promise that, all right, when I get this guy and when I conquer the army, I'm going to come back here and teach you a lesson. And what he describes here is actually a form of Canaanite torture. It's pretty graphic. If you were to translate this in a literal sense, it would be more like this. I will trample your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. Basically, what the Canaanites would do is they would take the thorns and the briars that he's referring to here are these thorny plants with these large thorns on it. And they would basically gather these up and they would throw them down in the roadway. And then they would take their enemies and lay them down naked on them, strap them down, and then drive over them with carts and wagons to drive the thorns into their flesh. Sometimes it would kill them, sometimes it would maim them. But nonetheless, it was a form of torture. That's what Gideon was promising these fellow Israelites because they refused to feed him. It's the first indication that maybe Gideon hadn't quite given up his Canaanite past. He's still thinking like a Canaanite in some respects. Well, then what happens next? He lets him be at this point, and he moves up to Penuel. If you look at verse 8, he went up from there to Penuel, and he spoke similarly to them, and the men of Penuel answered him just as the men of Succoth had answered. So he spoke to them also, and he said, when I return, I will tear down this tower. He's referring to their defensive tower there. It's a place where when armies would attack, the people of the city could escape to that tower. It was fortified, and they would have safety there. It was also offensive in some respects, that, or some relations where you would be able to attack the armies below, pouring things on them, dropping stones on them. So it served basically a military purpose. And he said, I'm going to come and wipe that out and leave you defenseless. So he makes another threat here as well. So what happens after that? Well, he goes up and he continues. He doesn't get the help for his men, but he still goes up and he attacks. We find that in verses 10 through 11 where he actually captures the two Midianite kings. But then he returns to carry out his promises to these two tribes, these two cities. Verses 10 through 21, it's a long section, I'll read it. Now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Kachor, and their armies with them, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the army of the sons of the east, for the fallen were 120,000 men. So in other words, just a reference here that this original army of 135,000 has been basically destroyed, brought down to 15,000, and again, Gideon's just doing the mop-up work here. Verse 11, Gideon went up by the way of those who lived in tents to the east of Nobah and Jabenah and attacked the camp when the camp was unsuspecting. When Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Harris, and he captured a youth from Succoth and questioned him. Then the youth wrote down for him the princes of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. He came to the men of Succoth and said, behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, concerning him whom you taunted me, saying, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands, that we should give bread to the men who are weary? He took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and he disciplined the men of Succoth with them. He tore down the tower of Penuel, and he killed the men of the city. So what we basically have here is Gideon goes on, and just as God has promised, he conquers the rest of the men, the 15,000. But something interesting takes place here. He doesn't actually kill the two kings. He kills everybody else, but he spares the lives of these two kings. And the question is why? Well, he takes these two kings, And he takes them back to the city, Succoth. And he parades them in front of the elders of the city. He finds this youth. The idea there is kind of this kidnapping idea. Kidnaps this youth. And then gets information out of him. Who are the leaders of Succoth? And the guy gives them 77 names. Gideon sends his army out. They gather up these 77 leaders. They bring them to probably the center of the city. And he brings out these two kings that he had captured. And he parades them in front of these 77 elders. And he says, see, I told you that I would capture these guys. And I would come back. And I would teach you a lesson. So instead of killing these two kings, which from a biblical perspective, he should have done. We might struggle with that a little bit, but it's a time of war, defense. They were supposed to wipe out the Canaanites. But instead, he takes these two men, kills everybody else, just takes the two kings, goes back to Succoth and says, see, I told you. And now, you're going to learn that you should have done what I asked. So he goes out and he gets those briars from the field, lays them down in the street, takes these men, likely straps them down, and drives over them with carts. And the text says, taught them a lesson. Punished them. We go on, and it says that he then went up to Penuel. Is that actually this verse or not? Goes up to Penuel. And he finds the people of the city, and they find their way to the tower, and he basically goes, and he kills all of them. Wipes out the Israelites in Penuel to teach them a lesson. Punishment. So we find this rather disturbing side of Gideon here in doing this. Remember, these are his brothers in the tribe of Israel. These are fellow Israelites. Yeah, they were expected to help. They should have helped him. But the question we have to ask is, was his response to their refusal to help a Christ-like or a godly act? And I would have to say, no, it wasn't. Look what happens after this. There's another side to this. It says in verse 17, he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of that city. Then he said to Zebah and Zalmunna, what kind of men were they whom you killed in Tabor? In other words, these guys had killed some people that Gideon knew about. And there's a little twist here. It says, and they said they were like you, each one resembling the son of a king. He said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if only you had let them live, I would not kill you. So apparently these two kings, probably in some military campaign, had killed some of Gideon's brothers here. And Gideon was aware of it. So there's a personal motive here as well. You might want to call this vengeance. He's not necessarily unjustified in killing these men because, again, God's commands were that they wipe out the Canaanites. But there's a bit of a vengeful motive here as well. Some internal anger directed towards these men, not just for them being Canaanites or for their campaign against the Israelites and constant oppression and stealing their crops, destroying their land. But he's got a personal vendetta, in some respects, against these two men. So verse 20, it says, so he said to Jether, his firstborn, rise, kill them. But the youth did not draw his sword, for he was afraid because he was still a youth. Then Zebah and Zalmunna said, rise up yourself and fall on us, for as a man, so is his strength. So Gideon arose and killed Zebah and Zalmunna and took the crescent ornaments which were on their camels' necks. And so we have this little episode here at the end of this battle where he takes these kings in, he parades them around the city, wants the men to see that he did exactly what he was going to do, taught them a lesson by torturing them, and then tells the son, you go kill these guys. Well, the son refuses. He's afraid for whatever reason. The man has to taunt him and say, you're a man, do it yourself. So he does. Takes out a sword and he kills them. There's one last thing in this text, though, that I think also makes this difficult for us. Look at verses 22 through 28. Gideon's going to do something here that again reflects that he might not have completely abandoned his Canaanite ways. Look at verse 22 and following. Then the men of Israel said, to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hands of the Midianites." But Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." That sounds good, doesn't it? Basically, they see what Gideon's done, and they say, "You should be our king, and your kids should be our king." In other words, set up a dynasty. You know, you'll rule, and then your kids will rule after you, and we'll forever have you as our king. And Gideon responds and says, "No, the Lord should rule over you." That sounds good. Sounds like a great, gracious response that Gideon gives, but then he does something. Verse 23, "I'm not going to rule over you. The Lord should." Verse 24, "Yet Gideon said to them," the word "yet" there is important in the English translation, "yet Gideon said to them, I would request of you that each of you give me an earring from his spoil. For they had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites." Verse 25, "They said, we will surely give them. So they spread out a garment, and each one of them threw an earring there from the spoil. The weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple robes which were on the kings of Midian, and besides the neck bands that were on their camels." What's interesting here is what Gideon actually does is he collects a tribute, a very kingly thing to do. So while he said, "I won't rule over you, and my sons won't rule over you, what you can do for me is you can give me a king's ransom." And so he collects gold earrings from them, and pendants, and 1,700 shekels of gold. That's what kings did. They collected tribute. And so even though Gideon claimed he was not going to rule as a king, we get this indication that maybe he actually did. Not in an official capacity, but he acted like a king. In fact, the text actually goes on, and you find out a little bit later in this passage that he actually creates a harem, has a concubine, and does other kingly things. But the last thing that he actually does here is found in verse 27. Gideon took that gold and everything that was given, and he made it into an ephod, basically an idol. And he placed it in his city, Ophrah, and all Israel played the harlot with it there, so that it became a snare to Gideon and his household. So what Gideon basically does is he forms a golden idol, takes it back to his hometown, sets it up in much the same way that his father had set up an altar to Baal and the Asherah. Now, he may have stamped Yahweh's name on it, but you look at the Ten Commandments, and what do we find? Spelled out in great detail, "You will not make any engraven images of me. I'm not worshipped that way." But that's what Gideon does. And so it's interesting, as we look at this story that starts out with the life of Gideon, the shy, timid farmer that grows into this valiant warrior, delivers Israel, obeys God, but then we see this shift begin to take place, where he begins to do some things that maybe came from his Canaanite past that he didn't quite completely give up. And his story actually ends with the creation of this ephod that caused Israel to go right back to the behavior that God had raised Gideon up to save them from. And then the story sort of, as it continues a little bit here, he in fact does begin to act like a king. We'll cover a little bit in a second here as we conclude this. So these are, I think, difficult and troubling things for us. What do we do with this? We have this man who, by many accounts, should be hailed as a man of faith and a hero of Israel, because God used him. God clearly raised him up and used him to deliver Israel. We can't question that at all. In fact, the author of Hebrews, chapter 11, we have what's called the Hebrews Hall of Faith, mentions Gideon as a man of faith. So what do we do with this? You see some rather interesting sides to him, his torture, maiming and killing of fellow Israelites. We see him collect gold and other items, plunder the Israelites, and fashion it into an idol. We see in verse 30 of chapter 8, he creates a harem. Again, forbidden by the Old Testament. Specifically targets kings. Tells them, if your king, and it's a reference to probably the dynasty of Saul and David and others, that you will not have a harem. You will not stack up ladies for yourself. But he also takes a concubine in verse 31. Again, clearly forbidden. And not only that, but the concubine he takes is a Canaanite concubine. Leads to a son named Abimelech, who he's our next individual we'll look at, who brought tremendous strife and destruction to Israel. What's interesting about this is we get into chapter 9, Gideon is continued to be mentioned, but the author only uses his Canaanite name, not his Israelite name. And why is that? I believe the author is trying to tell us something. That what we have in Gideon is a tragic end in some respects. He had returned in many respects to his Canaanite heritage. Now, it doesn't mean he abandoned the Lord, but he couldn't seem to shake that Canaanite heritage that he had. He wasn't quite willing to give that up when the Lord called him and raised him up. And I believe that one of the reasons why the author refers to him now in chapter 9 purely by his Canaanite name, the name his father gave him, one who contends with Baal, is the author's way of indicating that for us, a very subtle way. So what can we learn from this? Well, I think that one of the lessons we can learn is that Gideon is not alone. Let me run through a couple of famous figures that you're all familiar with. Abraham, called by God to raise up, become the parent of generations that would be as many as the sea, the sand of the sea and the stars of the sky. He would be the man who would birth Israel in many respects. And yet, do you ever remember Abraham having a struggle with obedience to God? Ever remember what he did? What was that? He was promised a son through Sarah, who was barren, right? So what did Abraham do? Somebody help me out.
He figured out another way.
Yeah, he thought he could. So he took Sarah's maid and he tried to have a kid, Ishmael. God, go ahead. I'm going to help you out here. I can do this. Well, God has to chastise him for it. So we have this man, Abraham, which none of us will ever doubt was a man of God. But he struggled, made a bad decision. How about Moses? Anybody remember a time in Moses' life where maybe there was some struggle? Moses, raised up by God. There's two episodes specifically that are somewhat troublesome about Moses. Anybody know what the first one was? He murdered a man, killed an Egyptian. What's the second thing that happened to Moses?
He beat
the rock. Yeah, what happened when he beat that rock?
Water came up,
but you know what happened? What God did then after that? Moses was prohibited to go into the promised land.
For 40 years.
Well, just at all. In fact, God took him all the way up and he says, you can look out and see it, but you will not enter it. Man of God, yet he struggled. God still used him. What about David? A man after God's own heart. You look at this episodes of David's life with being pursued by Saul, and yet there were times where he could have taken Saul's life, but he said, I will not rise up against the king. And you have this humble, gracious, godly man. But did he also have a difficult time? What happened?
Bathsheba.
He actually murders the chief of his army. He takes his wife, commits adultery with her first. Then to cover it up, he murders her husband. God has to send the prophet Nathan to David. And yet David is responsible for a good chunk of our Psalms, isn't he? He's called a man after God's own heart. How about Solomon? We studied the book of Ecclesiastes not too long ago. How about Solomon? Wisest man to ever walk the planet of the planet. God uses him, builds his temple, a permanent dwelling place, if you will, for God. God builds this amazing dynasty, this massive kingdom under Solomon's watch. But what did Solomon do? What were his struggles? The harem. 600 wives, 300 concubines, each one of these representing some kind of alliance he had created with the Canaanites, which violated Old Testament law. And the text tells us that he would build pagan shrines for them so his wives could go and worship their pagan gods. And we're told that at the end of his life, he had forsaken God. But yet, God used him to pen at least two of our books, Proverbs and Song of Solomon. How about Jonah? Steve did the book of Jonah for us, didn't he? What kind of prophet was Jonah? He was obviously a prophet used by God to help save a city. But what do we see in Jonah? Did Jonah struggle?
He ran the other way.
Ran the other way. God shook him up a little bit, put him in the belly of a fish. Figured that would get his attention. But then Jonah goes and he sits down on the ground and starts to pout. Not happy. And when God asks him why, he says, because you're going to save them. Just like you saved me, but you know, so what? It's them. You shouldn't save them. And he sits there and he pouts. God rises up, you know, he's out in the sun, it's hot, and so God brings up this bush, basically, to give him shelter. And then when God takes it away, Jonah gets all upset, and God has to say, are you kidding me? You're a little bummed out because you no longer have shade, but you want me to wipe out a whole entire city of people? Are they not more important than your stupid plant? But yet God used him, right? God knew exactly what he was going to get when he called Jonah. That's the thing that's amazing to me about that story. God knew exactly what Jonah would do every step of the way. He could have said, I'm not going to use that guy. What a bozo. But God raised him up anyway and used him for his purpose and his plan. We got some other examples. I won't go through all of them, but you have Peter in the New Testament. Jesus told him, you're going to deny me 3 times. And Peter did just that. There was a time where Paul even had to confront Peter because Peter's behavior wasn't what it was supposed to be. He was being somewhat hypocritical. He would treat the Jews one way and the Greeks the other way and had to be confronted. The Apostle Paul even refers to himself in Romans 7 as somebody who still struggled with sin, like the rest of us. Say, man, I don't get it. I don't do the things I want to do. I do the things I don't want to do, and it's just a mess. And it's because of that nasty sin beast that indwells me that I just can't always completely shake. And then he ends that by saying, thank God I have Jesus Christ. So what's my point in all this? Gideon really is not out of the norm, which is sad in one respect. But that's the kind of people God uses. And he definitely used Gideon. In fact, there's a place in the text here, we didn't cover it today, but where the Israelites were told that they didn't honor Gideon for all the good that he had done, and God was not happy with that. And so even in spite of what happened with Gideon, God still expected them to honor Gideon and Gideon's family for the good that he had done for Israel. It's almost like they should be diametrically opposed to one another, you know what I mean? But it's just this interesting dynamic in the Scriptures that we see that God doesn't only use perfect, sinless people, does he? He really doesn't. In fact, when he called us and saved us, it said that he saved us while we were yet sinners. So God calls sinners like us and like Gideon. And what he gets are sinners. I would have been much, much happier had God, when he saved me, wiped out that sin beast that dwells within me. Wouldn't we all just be much happier? I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but if I ask anybody here, figure out how to stop that sin beast from acting up sometimes. You figured it out? The answer to that is no. And so we could look at Gideon with a certain amount of, yeah, look at what he did. But that's the wrong response. We ought to be looking at what God did through a man like Gideon, but also recognize the tragedy in that. And that's sort of, I think, the first lesson I think I'll draw from this is that God doesn't just use perfect people. He uses people like us. And because he uses people like us, there's this tension sometimes when he uses us, when he saves us, this tension that exists between our old self and our new self sometimes. And sometimes that old self gets back in the way and shames God, much like Gideon did in some respects. But that doesn't prevent God from still using us. Meaning, God still is going to reach into our lives and say, even though I know what I'm getting, and even though I know you might not be perfect, I'm going to use you anyway. And he did that with Gideon. still accomplish his purposes. But that leads us to a second point that I think we have to learn, and that's this. Sin has consequences. So we should never be content saying, well, yeah, I'm just a sinner. That's okay. Gideon was. David was. Abraham was. Look at what Peter did. Oh, Paul, yeah, he's still struggling with sin. So, hey, I'm just like everybody else. So I'm content. That's all right. God's fine with it. You know, I recently had a situation where a friend of ours had sort of fallen off the planet. He disappeared for a little bit. We still saw him on Facebook and other things. But he called me a few weeks ago. And he's calling me because he was hoping that I would marry him and his girlfriend. But what he began to explain was that he had made a conscious, willful effort to rebel against God, went out and began to drink, began to sleep around, all kinds of behavior that he knew was wrong, and he justified it by saying, well, but I was being honest with God, and so he understands. And then when he finally decided to come out of his stupor, met this lovely Christian woman, she moved in immediately with them, and they began to engage in activity that they shouldn't have been engaging in. In the same house, living together. And he called me and said, I think we'd like to get married. I refused. I said, I don't think you get this. But he kept trying to justify, well, but yeah, all this rebellion, that was, God understands. Because I was honest with him. No, God doesn't understand. God was not happy with Gideon. God didn't say, yeah, that's just Gideon. He just got those issues. He was a Canaanite, and it's okay. And so I think that we have to be very careful when we look at Gideon. We should look at this tragic story and say, wow, that could be us too. Couldn't it? That could be me. The Bible tells us that we are to put off that old man and put on the new, and it is a process that takes place with the renewing of our mind. Gideon, in some respects, didn't completely shed that old cloak of Canaanite-ism. Just like sometimes we don't always take off that old coat and leave it off. Sometimes as we're walking out the door, we see that old coat there and we go, yeah, that was comfortable. I might just put that back on again. And after we do, regret doing so. And have to take that old clothes and put them off again. We are continually challenged in the Scriptures to walk in a manner worthy of our calling. Do you ever wonder why the New Testament is written the way it is? If you look at the Old Testament, it's a lot of stories and narratives. There's some declarative laws and things like that. But the New Testament, primarily aside from the Gospels and the book of Acts, the rest of it, maybe with the exception of Revelation, is basically corrective action, charges to us to change our behavior and live as a new man in Christ rather than living as the old man. There's constant instructions. Every one of Paul's letters is correcting an issue or issue, saying, you believers need to avoid this. Start living like Christ. Put off the old man. Don't return to the old clothes, which is a struggle that we see in Gideon here. So before we wave our finger at Gideon and go, wow, what a mess. He started off so great, didn't really end so great. We have to say, you know what? The amazing thing is that God still uses that. But we can't be content with that. We don't want to be like Gideon in that respect. But rather, put off the old Canaanite past, those old clothes. Not be satisfied with, that's just the way I am. That's just, you know, I sin. I'm just a poor sinner saved by grace. You know, it's funny because Paul doesn't refer to believers as sinners. He refers to them as saints, holy ones. Because that's positionally who we are. Paul was not content with anyone saying, yeah, he's just a sinner saved by grace. Don't worry about it. So our challenge this morning, I think, as we see this difficult and challenging passage, is again, not to wave our finger at Gideon. He did good for Israel, we're told. The Israelites were warned because they didn't honor him and his family as a result. So our challenge today, again, is to look at Gideon and realize that that could be us. And it shouldn't be. To not be content if it is.